Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. Tonight, we're presenting various takes on history and personal transformation. We have a full show for you this evening. Sarah Vowell joins us in the second half of the show to talk about her new book, Unfamiliar Fishes. Sarah is familiar to listeners of This American Life, and her new book is her take on the history of Hawaii. So you'll hear Sarah Vowell in the second half of the show, as well as an interview with Elise Ballard, an independent filmmaker and film producer. Her current book is called Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform. And right now, we're going to be listening to a conversation about California farm workers with Richard Stephen Street and Jerry Haslam. Richard Stephen Street is a photographer, historian, and journalist. He's well known for his multi-volume history of California farm workers, and particularly for his wonderful photo essays. Jerry Haslam lives in Pengrove, professor emeritus at Sonoma State University, written extensively on his early years in the Central Valley. He's written many books, both fiction and nonfiction. One of my favorite books of Jerry's is called Working Man Blues, Country Music in California. So stay tuned for this evening of stories of history and personal transformation. It's a novel idea.
I could settle down and be doing fine when I hear that freight rolling down the line. Then I hurry straight home and back, 'cause if I didn't go, I believe I'd blow my stack. I love you, baby, but you've got to understand, when the Lord made me, he made a rambling man.
Because of the large numbers of horses and mules and the nearby stables and corrals, wheat camps always had problems with flies. I worked for a month at a camp where 50 men were employed, recalled Nick Hansen, who labored year-round on a big wheat farm near Willows. All of the men searched the food for flies before eating. Every day we had pie for dinner. Before eating pie, the men would turn up the crust and search for flies. We often found a fly or two under the crust. If you ate more than one fly, you would surely lose your dinner within 10 minutes. But the flies also presented a certain odd opportunity. Each morning, as they gathered by the millions on the bunkhouse porch ceiling, a man arose before sunrise with newspapers doubled over the end of a stick. Lighting the paper, he held it under the flies as he walked along the porch. The blaze singed the wings of the flies, and they fell to the porch floor, recalled Hansen. Someone then swept the floor, gathered huge numbers of the still live but flightless insects, and fed them to the chickens. You would have been surprised how those chickens ate those flies.
Richard Stephen Street reading from Beasts of the Field. This is A Novel Idea. I'm Rosemary Manchester. I'm talking with Richard Stephen Street and Gerald Haslam, and we're discussing the history of agricultural workers in California. As I mentioned, I've only been in California about 20 years, and before I moved up here, I was in San Luis Obispo and did some hiking down there in the dunes. You've probably been to the dunes there at Guadalupe. And there in the dunes, the guides would talk about the places in the willow thickets where the Bindlemen had made their camps through the time that they were inactive. I guess it was a good place to spend the winter, although it seemed to me it would be rather wet, but they probably had picked some kind of shelters. And they were semi-permanent residences and groups of people who gathered there. And then in the next breath, the guide would talk about the remains of the movie, The Ten Commandments, that had been filmed there. And those were partially covered by sand, but every so often a storm would uncover part of the sets for The Ten Commandments. And I thought, what a juxtaposition. You know, the grandeur of Hollywood right there next to these homeless people who were living in the willow thickets. And that's kind of stayed with me as a metaphor of my experience of California.
Juxtaposition of imagery is a central recurring theme in the history of California farm workers. Just think about the beautiful fruit box labels. Absolutely gorgeous works of art. Lovely to look at. Collectible. And all the agricultural advertising. And the scene, or what a vineyard looks like in an aerial photograph. Or just what a luscious bunch of grapes looks like as you hold it up. Then you want to think about the labor that went into that. And I think also, you know, the farmer, what the farmer put into it. It turns out to be a very, very complex image when you start to analyze it and think about all the inputs and the sweat that went into producing that scene of abundance.
And you've both worked in the fields. I read several of your stories, Jerry, about when you were a kid in high school or maybe even junior high out there in the fields.
Yeah, we were not desperately poor, but it was in my family, it was believed that kids needed to work. It was a way of teaching them to be responsible. So when I was 12, I started working summers, originally chopping cotton and irrigating. And by the time I ended up, my last agricultural job was with Gamarra Brothers, working in the grape packing sheds at Coelho. And this would be 1958. And interestingly enough there, the plum job was to truck those grapes into an ice box car because it was dead of summer. And there were no non-whites who had that job. Adult Mexican Americans who had families didn't get that job, but white kids did. And I was one of the white kids.
Well, isn't it interesting that Gamarra is still in the news these days with that big fight with the United Farm Workers Union? It seems like they've been fighting since forever. They did sign a contract in 1970 and proclaimed everything was okay, but boy, oh boy, that's hard to maintain those things that you've won. They drift away unless you keep a hold of them.
One of my classmates in high school was one of the Gamarras, and I know him well. And he has a real sense that they've just been put upon, that their basic rights, their basic American rights, are being trampled. In his family, he says, feels aggrieved. And it's ironic, because we've talked a good deal about it. I've talked to him from the other side. There's not much communication that goes on.
What is this notion of the empowered people, that they feel aggrieved? I come across this so often.
Well, they worked hard. It's true that those people, when they came as immigrants, worked very hard and they struggled to get what they could get. And they were successful and then more than merely successful. Everybody isn't J.G. Boswell. They don't all come to California with those kinds of resources. But what they have done is tried to pull the stepladder up after they have reached the plateau. And they don't see that. For some, it's messianic. We were intended to control. This is our destiny. They really believe this. They have to convince themselves of it, I think, very often in order to justify what they end up doing. I'm thinking of people who I think are just excellent human beings to know, to sit across a table with them, wonderful people to know, hardworking people. Well, like rain, like water, like earth, like sun, labor is one of the God-given rights in California. And I think as long as that attitude persists, there's going to be exploitation.
Could you both talk a little bit about the United Farm Workers?
I remember very well the birth of all that. I think that in my mind, I saw there were two things going on that were extremely important. And one was simply the obvious empowerment of people without whom we couldn't have agriculture in California. And the second was the ethnic empowerment. From everything I've read and from what I have observed, it takes about three generations for migrants to become relatively accepted in the American mainstream. But there were a lot of people in the 60s who were already third and fourth generation, but who were trapped in towns like Huron or Parlier or San Joaquin, where they were given very little opportunity to rise in the society. And in some cases, whose spirits had been broken. That is, they didn't even realize they could rise in the society. And I think that one of the symbolic effects of the United Farm Workers in the 60s and 70s was to break that lid and say, wait a minute, we can do more. We can do this, but we can also do more. That was sort of my feeling about it at the time.
You both knew Cesar Chavez, right, Richard?
I can remember the first time I saw Cesar Chavez and photographed him. It was on the March on Salinas in 1979. And I photographed him speaking to a crowd in Greenfields, and he had been fasting for quite some time. Still a very fiery, charismatic character. And I can remember the last time I photographed him, which was in his coffin at Delano in 1993. And I had basically waited all day long and took the studio lighting equipment that I used to make a beautiful picture for, let us say, a big winery, and set it up in the funeral parlor and waited for everybody to clear out until the last veiled abuela passed through with her little baby on her shoulder. And took basically studio lift photographs of Cesar in his coffin. Very, very difficult to do that for many reasons, one of which is that people may think you're disrespecting the person. At that point, I was a historian. I was determined to record history. And I thought this man had to be photographed at that last moment before he disappeared forever. And I was in the middle of the moment. So I just sort of pushed myself through to get that image. And between those two images are many, many adventures and friendships. On that march on Salinas, there was, in front of the march, as it went through downtown Salinas, this woman dressed completely in red. She had on a Gred Growers Exchange hat, a red bandana over her face so that you could only see her eyes, in the style that women use in the fields to protect themselves from the pesticides in the sun, and a red turtleneck sweater. She looked gorgeous, but it was also a political statement. And she was out in front of this parade carrying the American flag, behind which came the Virgin of Guadalupe. And I wanted to photograph her because it was such an incredibly smart and photogenic image. But I really couldn't grab the photograph. So I met her and made arrangements to photograph her. But to do that, I had to meet the family and I had to meet the abuela, who was going to check me out. So I came over to the little house that they lived in on Main Street in Salinas and was treated to a dinner of liver tacos, which is the first and last time in my life that I've ever had liver tacos. Absolutely delicious. I can't say I'll ever have them again. She checked me out, and the next morning we went out in the open shade in the fields, and I did portraits of this woman, and she looks like she belongs on the cover of Vogue or Vanity Fair. That's one of many, many meals that I've had with farm workers who take you in, treat you like a king. Another was in the middle of Camp Pendleton Marine Base with a little group of Oaxacans with whom I could not really speak because they didn't speak Spanish and I did not speak Oaxacan. But I would visit them every day for a couple of weeks, and I would visit at dinner time, which was the highlight of their day after working in the surrounding strawberry fields and then disappearing down into this little ravine surrounded by trees and deep foliage, where they lived in these little doghouse-sized hooches. I think that's the best way to describe them, up on plastic milk carton carriers because it would flood through there, and this was the only way they could make sure they would always be dry. And the highlight of their day was in the evening as it grew dark. They would build a fire, and I remember how they lit the fire. They would get their plastic shopping bags from Safeway, and they would light one on fire and then drip the burning plastic onto the kindling and slowly build their cooking fire. And then they would just go through this elaborate procedure to prepare their meal and then to prepare their burritos and wrap them in aluminum foil for their breakfast the next morning. And this would take an hour and a half, and it would be pitch dark down in there. The only light is the campfire, and the music would come from a little transistor radio hanging from the tree, which they turned on for 1 hour during this procedure. And that was just the most wonderful meal to partake. You know, I had dozens of experiences like that. So when I think between Cesar, the first time I saw him, and the last time I saw him, it spans thousands of experiences like that.
And those photographs of Cesar are in your book, Photographing Farm Workers in California.
Well, a couple of them are in the photography book. They're in, the originals are in color. They're converted to black and white.
Oh.
This was actually a big issue in putting the book together. But for the purposes of creating an affordable book, a high-quality affordable book, we had to do it in black and white. There's a wonderful National Geographic photograph of a candlelight protest in the Imperial Valley, originally in color, that we published in black and white. And that was a whole struggle, one of thousands of struggles you grapple with as you put together a book.
I want to tell our listeners the specifics of that book. The title of it is Photographing Farm Workers in California by Richard Stevens Street. Both of these books by Richard, both that book and Beasts of the Field, are in the public library, so that if you want to preview them before you go out and buy them, you can get them from the public library, so they are available. But the photographs are stunning. Some of them are taken by Richard himself, and others by photographers. Ansel Adams has a photograph in here, a couple of Dorothea Lange, and it's simply a stunning book. Again, the name of it is Photographing Farm Workers in California. And Richard's other book is Beasts of the Field. And together they make a wonderful retrospective of the history of California farm workers.
And you get to look through the eyes of the greatest photographers ever to work on the planet. This was the big discovery in this book, that every photographer of consequence, every great photographer of consequence in California, at some point, for some reason, in some way, photographed farm workers. Some of the discoveries are completely astounding. For example, the fact that you find Ansel Adams out there photographing cotton pickers in Fresno in 1930. This is 5 years before Dorothea Lange really revolutionizes photography and popularizes the form of documentary coverage. This is completely omitted from all biographies of Ansel Adams, and Ansel Adams actually crops up in three other places. In the 50s, as part of his commercial work, he's out there photographing on the farms, and he does portraits of braceros, and he goes into the labor camp and goes inside and photographs farm workers drinking beer at the bar. And then, of course, in 1942, he's at Manzanar photographing Japanese farm workers working in the fields that they have created at Manzanar or relocation camp. And then he's out there in 1960 doing a commercial shoot for Paul Masson Winery, and he creates these terrific images of farm workers using horse-drawn plows to cultivate what's called the Sky Vineyard there. Well, this is not in any of the biographies of Ansel Adams, the great landscape photographer and fine artist, but it shows a dimension to him that has been heretofore omitted from the record. Well, he's surrounded by a cast of characters that you could not possibly dream up. Hansel Meath Hagel and Otto Hagel, who lived close to here up in Santa Rosa, probably the most left-wing of all photographers in California, photographing in the fields in 1930 and drifting with migrants while they're photographing and continuing to photograph up into the 1960s.
I want to give both of you an opportunity to talk about what you're working on now. Jerry?
I'm just finishing a biography of S.I. Hayakawa, actually only up to 1955, 1906 to 1955, when he becomes an American citizen, moves to San Francisco, and a couple of other fairly traumatic things happen in his life. Then I'll decide whether I do a second volume. And unfortunately, the first draft is completely done, so now I'm polishing.
And when might we expect to see that come out? Do you know?
Oh, not for at least a year and a half, because I have a new novel coming out in the fall.
Oh.
So you don't want to bring them out concurrently if you can avoid that.
That's right. So two new books coming out.
Two new books coming out, yes.
Then at least one to follow.
I hope.
Wonderful. Yeah. Oh, that's great. And Richard?
Well, I wanted to ask Jerry about writing biography, because I think, you know, biography is really the highest and most interesting form of writing. And this is a bit of a step for you, isn't it? I don't think that you've done biography before, but what a wonderful biography to tackle.
I did capsule biographies in Working Man Blues, and that's what intrigued me. I don't know if the way I do biography, it's the highest form. It's certainly the most difficult. I'm really finding it daunting, because when I write a novel, I have some control over the lives of the people I'm dealing with. And in this biography, I don't. I also learn things I just assume not know. And then have to make some decisions about how much is appropriate to tell and how to tell it. So I find it very difficult, but I've also found it rewarding.
I'm very surprised that this seems to be the first biography of Hayakawa, a man who I would have thought would have warranted biographies up to this time. My question to you is, why has it taken a while to get a biography of Hayakawa going? Did the papers just open up now?
No, the family is all, I think, has for at least 10, maybe even 10 years, maybe even longer, been perfectly happy to have someone look at the papers. I think he's been too politically charged. No one knows quite what to do with him. You know, he was considered to be a leftist in the 30s and 40s, and then at the end of his life, he's not considered to be a leftist. No one knows whether the society shifted, or he shifted, or academia shifted, and what happened is all of those things, of course. What I've done in this particular book, for example, is I've opened the prologue is Hayakawa pulling out those famous wires at San Francisco State, and then the first chapter begins with his parents migrating from Japan to Canada, and I end when he gets to San Francisco State, and that's where this volume ends. But when you talk to people, it's very difficult at times to get them to discuss what happened or what they saw or what he said. They're too busy giving you opinions, and the opinions are almost always political, based largely on what a lot of people see as a sea change at the end of his life.
Did you gain any insights into him? Is he still a mystery to you at the end of your research so far?
Well, my conclusion at this point, I'm trying to work inductively and just take things as they come and try to see what's happening. But I think by 1955, he was extraordinarily frustrated at his inability to achieve a high-level academic position, and that he came to understand that aligning himself with general semantics had been a mistake, because he had been a first-rate literary scholar in the 30s. He'd been publishing in Poetry Magazine and in national magazines. And then he turned to this marginal pursuit. As it sunk, he sank with it. So I think he was a rather frustrated man at that point in his life. He also was a man who tended to bury his pain. He would not talk about being discriminated against. It was just something he said there was no point in pursuing it. And yet, I think that sort of thing festered in him. He was an extraordinary man. He was the first non-black columnist for the Chicago Defender. He ran around with people like Count Basie and Langston Hughes when he was in Chicago. And yet he comes out here and he can't even get an interview at Cal or Stanford. I think there's a level of frustration in him that begins to manifest itself strongly at the end of his life.
And what about the internment experience during World War II? Does that figure in the family history and in his development?
Well, he was a Canadian, and they did intern and relocate Canadian Japanese. In fact, in some ways, it was worse there because about 80% of the population of Japanese Canadians were in British Columbia, and so they were basically all moved. He had one aunt who was interned, and her family, of course. He lived in Chicago, and so one of the things that he did, he and his wife, opened their house to people who were being relocated, which was one of the options. And a number of internees actually lived with Hayakawa's, including Muriaki Murayama, who was later became the major physician in the research on sickle cell anemia. But they came, they lived in the Hayakawa house until they could find a place of their own. But he was never interned. He visited the camp at Granada in Colorado. I think one of the situations in his life that is most troubling is that he did not see the gravity of internment in the United States. He believed that in Canada, relocation had been a good thing because it broke up communities that were making no particular effort to be Canadian and were, as a result, suffering severe discrimination. He didn't see that in the United States there was already a process going on of assimilation that by generation to generation, by the time people got to be sensei, they were very much American, and they were moving into careers, moving into locales where they'd not previously been welcome. He tended to judge the American experience based on his Canadian perceptions, and that didn't make him any friends because he defended internment on the basis of breaking up ethnic communities.
I can't wait for this book. I don't know if I can wait a year and a half, Jerry.
We'll see if the Hayakawa family can wait.
And Richard, tell us what you're currently working on.
What I've just finished is the 750-page text version of the photo book, where I have written about all the photographers who have worked in the field since 1850. And basically, it's a survey of every great photographer ever to set foot in the American West as they ventured into the fields and made their discoveries and contributions. And it's sort of a longitudinal slice of the history of photography as it focused on a class of people. I'm detouring next to collect all my photo essays from the past 25 years and publishing them under the title of Knife Fight City and Other Essays, with the title taken from the lead essay, which is on Huron, California's poorest town, which nobody has ever heard of, a town that has about 4,000 population 9 months of the year and then swells to 12,000 during the lettuce harvest. All the lettuce you eat in March and November comes out of Huron when this town turns in basically to the Wild West. It's a town with 7 legal labor camps and 14 bars. No McDonald's, no Boy Scouts, no Burger King. And I stumbled into this story while I was doing a story on pesticide poisoning at Kesterson Reservoir, and I got tired in the afternoon and went looking for something to eat and something to drink. And I stumbled into Huron, and I was sitting on the sidewalk sipping a cola, and the chief of police rolled up and opened the back door and said, "Get in." Well, I got in, and I wondered, you know, am I going to wind up in a canal somewhere, or what is this guy, a real redneck? And, you know, he turned out just to be the most fascinating, open, and interesting police officer you could imagine. And I rode with the cops in Huron for 8 years during all the lettuce harvests, and that was my into the town, at a time when it was split not between Anglos and Hispanics, but between two rival group of Hispanics. One I call the old-time Hispanics, who wanted to keep things as they were, that is, this little crummy little farm town that turns into the Wild West, where the economy is based on bars and prostitutes and labor camps. And another group that wanted to build a high school and wanted to use the cops to clean the place up, and were using the cops to start a little league and everything. This was such a revolutionary move that eventually the police department was disbanded, and all the people I got to know and love were sent off to duty at other police departments around the country. And I had to write the story up at that point because I wanted to stay with it for as long as I could. And so Knife Fight City and other essays is full of stories like this about, it might be called the hidden California, the hidden rural California that sort of lurks below the surface but is out there and is so intrinsically interesting that it compels you to write and photograph about it.
Jerry, I had the feeling that you had heard of Huron.
Yes. I have a friend, Manya Gonzalez, who's the only PhD ever raised in Huron, as far as we know. Huron, to me, is like a machine for the creation of more and more farm laborers, because there's not really any easy way out for anybody. And so I'm delighted that Richard's writing about it, because the more exposure that gets, the better the chances are that it can be improved to some degree.
Mm-hmm. I'd like our listeners just to get a flavor of the writing of both of you. Jerry, would you read just a little bit from a couple of paragraphs from Oildale, which is the final essay in your new book, Haslam's Valley?
Oildale. To gaze deep within myself, I walked the streets of Oildale. On December 23rd, 1985, frigid tule fog obscuring all but the nearest yards and houses, I wander up McCord Street. No sidewalks here, but many trailer parks in an area where once Dust Bowl migrants built hovels. And I notice two batty roosters scratching and jerking on a patch of brown Bermuda grass, eyeing one another, but ignoring, as nearly as I can tell, two wild doves feeding with them. I stop and for a few moments stand motionless, watching while my breath bursts white. Then one dove flies with a muffled whirr, and the other poses warily. Both roosters pause, fighters awaiting the bell. With a hollow warble, the second dove climbs swiftly into the gray surrounding us, leaving me on the sandy border between lawn and street. I notice in two pickups parked on the far border of the Bermuda, one ancient and huge, the other small, new, crowned with 4 yellow fog lights. On the older vehicle's blotched surface, someone has painted, "Trust Jesus." A bumper sticker on the new one says, "If you love something, set it free. If it returns, it is yours. If it doesn't, hunt it down and kill it." The smaller pickup is metallic red, as are the roosters.
Breathtaking.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Jerry. I'm going to give you a choice, Richard. I picked out a paragraph, but I really should have let you choose something that you want to read. So, your choice.
This does not have a title, but if it did have a title, it might be called The Naked Pumpkin-Headed Chinese Cook. People who knew Chinese cooks enjoyed reeling off stories about their personality quirks, their struggle with the language and culture, and about tricks played on them and the jokes they played on their employers. Mostly they recalled the central role that they played in farm life. They most commonly spoke of how industrious and mysterious they were. A mule skinner named Jean Kay grew fond of telling the story about Hung Wu, a Chinese cook who worked on the Jacobs Ranch southeast of Guernsey in the southern San Joaquin Valley. The cook had not been on the ranch more than 2 weeks when he dazzled everyone with a series of roast goose dinners. As none of the mule skinners and plowboys had been hunting and knew of no one else who had been, they asked Hung where he got the geese. "Me catch 'em," was all he said. After the third meal, the men could not contain their curiosity, and when they left for the field one morning, Kay hid in the barn and watched Hung Wu all day long. Shortly, the cook emerged from his shack, looked around, and slid into the willows bordering the large pool fed by Jacob's slough. Following him, Kay watched Wu strip naked, weigh himself down with heavy gang belt weights, then slip a hollowed-out pumpkin over his head. The pumpkin had peak holes cut out in it, and it allowed Wu to wade up into the slough and sneak up on bands of geese he had lured in with wheat seeds. Once beside a feeding goose, he grabbed it by the feet and pulled it under the muddy water and broke its neck before it could squawk. Soon he did the same to another goose. After three had disappeared, the pumpkin started back towards the bank. That evening, Kay confronted Wu with what he had witnessed. The cook told him it was an old Chinese method for catching geese that his forefathers had used for thousands of years. Quote, "You break his neck and you hold him between your knees while you catch one more," was all he said. Hung Wu would later be remembered by Frank F. Latta as one of the most famous Chinese cooks ever to burn meat in a San Joaquin Valley plow camp.
I want to thank you both so much for being here, Richard Stephen Street and Gerald Haslam. It's been a treat to talk to you and to listen to you particularly. And I want to give the names of the books again for our listeners. Jerry's latest book is called Haslam's Valley, published by Heyday Press in Berkeley. And Richard Stephen Street's books, Beasts of the Field and Photographing Farm Workers in California, published by Stanford Press. You're listening to A Novel Idea. You've just heard my conversation on California farm workers with Richard Stephen Street and Gerald Haslam. In the second half of our show will be a conversation with Sarah Vowell about her new book, Unfamiliar Fishes, her take on the history of Hawaii, and then an interview with Elise Ballard. Her current book is Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform. So stay tuned. We're going to take a short break.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Welcome back to A Novel Idea. All of us have experiences that change our lives. Elise Ballard, an independent filmmaker and producer, has written a book called Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform. Some of the people she spoke with are public figures such as Maya Angelou, Desmond Tutu, and Deepak Chopra. Now we'll hear a conversation with Elise Ballard and Suzanne Lang, who produces Novel Idea.
Ever know, and I think to myself, wonderful world.
Elise Ballard, happy to have you talking with us today in anticipation of your trip up here to Sonoma County on Friday, April 15th.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Yeah, and your book, Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform, seems like it's a portion of this large project of yours, which includes interviews with many, many people and film and what you're building on the web. So if you could give our listeners a flavor of what the book is about and what led you to write it, and we'll take it from there.
Sure, of course. Well, Epiphany is a collection of interviews that I have done over, I would say I started it seriously about 2 years ago. And I have tried to interview people from all walks of life, from all over the world. And I asked everyone the same question, what is your greatest epiphany in life? And I asked for the story of it. And I asked them, did your life change? And if so, how? The book, there are 58 stories in it with people from everyone like Desmond Tutu and Maya Angelou, Barry Manilow, Craig Newmark of Craigslist, to my fifth grade teacher, to friends of friends and people that I are my best friends that I had never asked this question of before. And so it's just a very unique swath of people I tried to get. As a filmmaker, I started asking people on camera if they'd ever had an epiphany, and if so, you know, if they could tell me the story. And I started getting these stories, and they were so interesting and entertaining, and people are so compelling when they'll share these stories with you, that I thought, you know, I'll put them together as an independent film. And then, more importantly, what was interesting to me is that later I would find myself thinking about these stories, just randomly in situations I was in, and I was realizing that what they were sharing with me was helping me. I was able to utilize this wisdom that seems to come through these moments in my own life. And so I mentioned it to someone about doing it as an independent film, and one thing led to another, and I was developing it for them as a reality show series and a documentary. And in developing the television treatment, I was writing the stories, and I realized how powerful these were also in the written form, as well as when you get to see them on video. So one thing led to another, and I have this book that Random House just put out in January, and I have a website with as many of the interviews as I can filmed called epiphanychannel.com, and about half the interviews you can watch people talk about their epiphanies.
And I want to encourage our listeners to go to that website, that's epiphanychannel.com. And I did view many of them. In fact, I was viewing them on YouTube and really couldn't stop watching. Also, it seems like there's a lot of common threads that run through people's stories about these life-changing realizations. And in your book, you make that observation that there seems to be some central characteristics that run through these epiphanies.
Right. I found that four things were always common when an epiphany changed someone's life. And that was that they were listening, they were paying attention for whatever reason, they were open to these moments. And the second thing that always happened is that they believed in the truth of what these moments meant to them, I say 1,000%. You know, they never had a doubt when it happened in the moment, what it meant to them and what that truth was, and they still don't tout it to this day. And through that belief, they all took action. That's the third thing that always happened. Every single person, when an epiphany changed their life, they took the first step towards taking action on what they knew to be true for them. And most of us, if not all of us, we had no idea what the second step would be. You know, we would just take the first step towards change. And then the fourth thing that I found in every epiphany came into play, which I call serendipity, meaning it seems as if the world conspires to support you, you know, as if the world then reveals the second step and then the third step and then the fourth step to confirm, yes, this is true for you. Yes, you're on the right path. Yes, this is the direction you're supposed to be going. So those were the four things that I found were constant, no matter who they were, no matter where they were, no matter what was going on. Those are the four common denominators.
And that's running through all these people. You have an amazing range of people that you interviewed, from entertainers like Barry Manilow and Ally McGraw, an actress, to Maya Angelou and Desmond Tutu. And what was so intriguing was the different context of people's stories, yet there were simple truths that were very present in all of them. Why do you think sometimes we avoid these truths?
It's scary to make change. So I do think that a lot of times it's about freedom from fear.
Something that I saw running through these stories, and they very much are stories that we can enjoy and learn from, is that notion of, as Kristen Neff calls it, self-compassion. And one of the other subjects said, you are the one you are waiting for, and
yeah,
that it came very much back to who you are and being who you are in the moment. And that sounds almost cliche, but it's something that when you realize it, you know what that means.
Even Ian Bailey, I think, said that. He goes, you know, this might seem trite, but he goes, we all hear that we're all one. We all hear that we're connected. You know, we all hear these things intellectually. We know it. I think Ally McGraw talked about it as well, knowing things intellectually or knowing them, you know, by studying or hearing. But when you experience it, when I call it, when it gets in your cells, then you realize how true it is. And I think the study of these instances and these stories, at least for me, has been an example of how true it is. I opened the book with G.W. Bailey's Epiphany. He says, when one life changes, many lives change. And I found that to be the case. You know, I've had the privilege of seeing hundreds of these stories and seeing, getting to experience how, when someone changed, all the people around them and what they've done in the world and how the world has changed because of it. And that's a theme throughout all of them.
And it's important to share our stories, and you seem to be encouraging others, readers, visitors to your website to share their stories as well, and that there's a power in that.
Yes, I hope they will. There's a tab at the very top of my website called Share Your Epiphany, and people are writing in these beautiful epiphany stories.
Well, I want to encourage our listeners again to come and see you and talk to you at Copperfields.
And I love meeting everyone that wants to talk about epiphanies or that's read this book. It's so fun for me.
That's April 15th at 7 in Petaluma. And thanks so much for joining us, and really did enjoy visiting your site and seeing the films of some of these interviews as well. So continued success.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having me on today. It was a pleasure.
That was Suzanne Lang in a conversation with Elise Ballard. Elise will be appearing at Copperfields in Petaluma this Friday, April 15th at 7 p.m. And finally this evening, an interview with Sarah Vowell, familiar to many of our listeners from This American Life. Sarah Vowell was recently at Copperfields Petaluma to introduce her latest book, Unfamiliar Fishes. It's a history of Hawaii. I've been waiting for a new history of Hawaii for years, ever since James Michener's marvelous book, Hawaii, which, of course, dealt in great detail with the early days, the coming of the missionaries, the sailors, the conflict between the missionaries and the sailors, the development of Hawaii, commercialization, and finally, American domination and statehood. Katie Kasbin conducted an interview that evening with Sarah Vowell, and we're bringing that to you now.
You said in your book that Hawaii interested you because it was attacked, and you went there for Pearl Harbor and then got into the culture. So tell me more about your fascination with the attacking aspect of places, and then also what you knew of Hawaii before you got there.
Well, the first time I went there was to see the Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor. And I guess, you know, I'm a New Yorker, and maybe, I mean, I don't know that I was very cognizant of this at the time, but the first time I went was in 2003. Certainly the attack that happened in New York in 2001 people started talking about Pearl Harbor a lot more, and that must have just kind of sunk in and made me want to go there. And you know, in 1993, when the Clinton administration issued that apology resolution where the U.S. government apologized for ill treatment of the Native Hawaiians, so there was that. And you know, maybe we spent 10 minutes of that on the overthrow of the Queen in American history. Not a lot, and I wasn't overburdened with a ton of intricate knowledge.
Tell me actually about Owen. He's actually one of my favorite parts of the book, your nephew.
Well, he was about 7 or 8 most of the times I would take him over. I mean, the reason I would bring him, I like traveling with him, but I don't know how to drive, so I need his mother to drive me around sometimes. When his mother, my twin sister, who drives me sometimes when I'm doing reporting trips that require automobile transportation. He has perspectives on things as a kid that are obviously different than mine. When I took him to the whaling museum in Maui, I mean, I get so wrapped up in the worlds of what I'm researching, you know, like with whaling, learning as much as I can about the mechanics of it and the, you know, the harpoons and the way the whalers would process the whales and the importance of whale oil in the world. It was, you know, basically was oil until petroleum was discovered, and you know, how the candles made from whale oil were the cleanest, brightest burning candles the world has ever known, and just all of the parts of the whale that were had so many industrial applications, and you know, the whale baleen being used in corsets and umbrellas, and how like parts of the whale was in perfume. And I just get kind of mired in the details, and then taking him to the whaling museum, he loves animals, and seeing all the like whale butchery and all the tools for whale butchery and photos of whales being processed and whales being killed, he was so outraged by it, you know, and he couldn't believe that people would do that to whales. Sometimes he just kind of brings me down to earth a little bit, and then other times it's sort of funny and what he picks up on.
In your research, do you find that you get bogged down a little in the cynicism as you go back to McKinley and James Cook, and it keeps going back? It seems like Industrial Revolution. Do we have any hope in our country at the moment?
There's always hope, I guess. I don't know that hope is the reason people read my books. You know, I don't write those books about some inspirational figure who, you know, makes everyone happy to be alive. My books are kind of like pretty solidly in the gray area of things. But I think, I don't know, more and more, even the stories I tell or the people I'm drawn to writing about whom I find objectionable, I think more and more I at least try and understand why they would do what they do. So do I think there's hope? I mean, when Americans think about Hawaii, their eyes sort of glaze over, and I don't even think they picture people living there. People in the continental U.S. probably, I think they just kind of picture some uninhabited beach. Or if it's inhabited, it's just inhabited by the guy who's bringing them their umbrella drink, you know. I guess the point of my book is to shed light on how Americans have changed that place, and frequently for the worse, and to at least be aware of the contribution and sacrifices made by the Hawaiian people in our path to world domination. So, I mean, I think there's hope in just information and knowledge. There's no hope in ignorance. Is this a happy-go-lucky, upbeat book? Not really, you know. I don't read those books. I don't even know what they would be, but I certainly don't know how to write them.
Punahou School, you talked about that. I would love for just a second to talk about the two different schools, and if you can reflect on maybe our system of education. How do you look at the two different schools that you talk about in your book? It's a really fascinating story.
Well, Punahou is the school President Obama attended, and it was founded by the New England missionaries as a school to educate their own children. So, I mean, it has a lot of historical import in Hawaiian history just because all of the missionary children, the ones who went on to found the sugar plantations and went on to overthrow the Hawaiian queen, almost all of them attended that school. And so, There's that, and then are you talking about the school for the royal children? And so then the King of Hawaii asked the missionaries to also start another school to educate the children of the chiefs, the aristocrats. And so the missionaries, they were kind of, they had their priorities, and their priorities were trying to save as many Hawaiian souls as possible. And so they kind of the school for both their own children and certainly the school for the children of the chiefs, they sort of were afterthoughts, and the best and the brightest missionaries did not staff those schools because, you know, the man who was the first teacher at Punahou was the missionary who showed up who couldn't figure out how to speak Hawaiian, so they just stuck him, you know, educating their own kids. And then the missionary couple who were asked to start the school for the royal children, they hadn't even, you know, gone to college. And so the wife, and I think one of her letters talks about how at that school, at the chief's children's school, her husband was staying up late every night trying to read ahead so he could teach the royal children, you know, math and stuff that he didn't know. So, like, these schools were not really priorities for the missionaries, but they were certainly, both of them were schools for the elite, and the chief's children's school ended up educating the five final monarchs of Hawaii, and then Punahou is educated, you know, the men who grew up to be the white oligarchs. So they're both pretty important, influential schools. And I mean, it seems like the one thing that the children who attended the chief's children's school and their future foes, the alumni of Punahou, the one thing they all had in common was a kind of a little bit of a disdain for the missionaries, for the old missionaries and their puritanical ways. You know, like when Sanford Dole, who becomes the president of the Republic of Hawaii, when he goes away to college in the U.S. and in Massachusetts, and he writes these letters home that horrify his missionary father, you know, about how he's been to a Unitarian church and he enjoys nude statues and he likes music and dancing, and he's not going to be a minister, he's going to be an attorney. And then he has to write letters, you know, trying to answer his parents' qualms that the legal life is one that leads to, you know, iniquity. And same thing with all of the royal children who attended the chief's children's school, taught by these New England missionaries. They all kind of, you know, bucked against the constraints of that too. So even though these two schools raised up these all these kids who would grow up to have battles in public life with one another, and none of them really became the New England puritanical types that their teachers were hoping they would be.
There's so much in this book, we could talk forever about all the details, and the part that struck me the most in the book is the yellow feather skirt. Mm-hmm. There, if you can talk about what it was like to actually see it.
Yeah, the feather work, they're the cloaks and the helmets that the chiefly class wore, made from mainly yellow feathers but also black and red ones, one of the kind of classic Hawaiian folk traditions for the chiefly class. But then the daughter of Kamehameha the Great, Princess Nahi Ene'ene, for her the longest piece of feather work ever created, they made this skirt for her, and it was meant to symbolize her procreative power. It was kind of a fertility symbol, and she was a little girl, you know, she was probably somewhere between 8 and 10 years old when they made it for her, because she was kind of caught between the missionaries and the Hawaiian traditionalists she lived with. She was constantly pulled back and forth between the two worlds and sort of driven mad because of it. But the skirt was woven in the Hawaiian royal class. Brother-sister marriages were the most prized unions, just because they could concentrate a clan's, the spiritual power of its bloodlines. And so the skirt was meant to be a fertility symbol, and also woven to symbolize her future procreation with one of her brothers. And she refused to wear it, but sort of like on, you know, a couple of ceremonial occasions, kind of sat on top of it wearing her proper New England clothes. But she's such a tragic figure and you know, spent her life kind of pulled between the two worlds. And, you know, she was in love with her brother, and but then the missionaries would, you know, convince her for a while to stay away from him. But then she, you know, she had two weddings and marriages, one with her brother in the old traditional Hawaiian way, one with a guy, a traditional marriage that the missionaries approved of. And her brother is probably the father of the one child she had, and that child only lived a day. She was the very tragic figure. And this skirt, which is this phenomenal piece of art that's in the Bishop Museum collection, this 20-foot long feather skirt that's woven of I think feathers from the o'o bird, which is now extinct in Hawaii. And it's such a symbol of loss, you know, because I mean, she was the daughter of Kamehameha the Great, and Kamehameha the Great, the founder of the Hawaiian kingdom, is the only Hawaiian monarch who had children who lived to rule in adulthood. And so, because Nahi'ena'ena died, you know, by the time she was 20, and having had only the one baby who, you know, died the day it was born, that skirt is very fraught with the symbolism of what happened to the future kingdom, just because all of the hopes of a thriving Hawaiian monarchy, that skirt sort of symbolized the demise of that dynasty and the Hawaiian monarchy, and then the Hawaiian kingdom, which is to say an independent sovereign Hawaii, all of that sort of died. And so this skirt, which was woven as a symbol of fertility and life, it ends up becoming the thing that's draped over the coffins of the kings when they die, you know. So it's a very beautiful object, but it's also the person it was made for in the story it signifies is melancholy at best, you know.
Thank you so much for taking this time.
Sure.
This, and for those of you, I hope everyone runs out and buys this book immediately. And if anyone thinks history is boring, this is a perfect example of this book and the amount of work that you've done, the research to go in and show both sides, researching. We didn't even get to touch on Massachusetts. That is one of the most incredible stories when you go back there through the lives of the missionaries and how they got together and came over on the boats, and it seems so like crazy how it happened to get them there. And then once they were there, it's, well, you just have to read the book.
I guess so.
Thank you.
Okay, this one's for Gabby.
That was Katie Kasman interviewing Sarah Vowell on her new book, Unfamiliar Fishes. This evening, we've been talking about history and personal transformation. Barbara Quick was a recent guest on this show, talking about her books, Vivaldi's Virgins and A Golden Web, a couple of her books that combine history with personal transformation. Barbara's presenting a workshop at Book Passage in Marin County that will be on Saturday, April 30th from 10 to 4. I hope you've enjoyed our show this evening. I want to thank our guests, Sarah Vowell, Elise Ballard, Richard Stephen Street, and Jerry Haslam, and our contributors, Suzanne Lang, who produces the show, and Katie Kasman, events coordinator at Copperfields Books. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, reminding you that there's no such thing as too many books.
Someday you wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind. Be where trouble melts like lemon drops, high above the chimney top, that's where you'll find me. Oh, somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly.
what you did to oh why can't I? Well, I see trees all. Oh.